Now, as most know, our reading tonight is from the first book of Kings again, and chapter 11. The first book of Kings and chapter 11. And we read at verse number 1. 1 Kings chapter 11 and verse 1. But King Solomon loved many strange women together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites, of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, Ye shall not go into them, neither shall they come into you, unto you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it came to pass, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Zidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and went not fully after the Lord, as did David his father. Then did Solomon build an high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill that is before Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the children of Ammon. And likewise did he for all his strange wives, which burnt incense and sacrificed unto their gods. And the Lord was angry with Solomon, because his heart was turned from the Lord God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice, and had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods, but he kept not that which the Lord commanded. Wherefore the Lord said unto Solomon, Forasmuch as this thing, as this is done of thee, and thou hast not kept my covenant and my statutes which I have commanded thee, I will surely rend the kingdom from thee, and will give it to thy servant. Notwithstanding in thy days, I will not do it for David thy father's sake, but I will rend it out of the hand of thy son. Howbeit, I will not rend away all the kingdom, but will give one tribe to thy son, for David my servant's sake, and for Jerusalem's sake, whom I have chosen. And the Lord stirred up an adversary unto Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. He was of the king's seed in Edom. Verse 17 tells us that this man fled and went down into Egypt. Verse 23, and God stirred him up another adversary, Rezon the son of Eliada, which fled from his lord Hadad-Ezer, king of Zobah, and he gathered men unto him and became captain over a band. And then about both men, at the end of verse 25, we are told that they abhorred Israel. He abhorred Israel and reigned over Syria. Now, verse 26, and Jeroboam the son of Nebat, an Ephrathite of Zerida, Solomon's servant, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow woman, even he lifted up his hand against the king. And this was the cause that he lifted up his hand against the king. Solomon built Milo, and repaired the breaches of the city of David his father, and the man Jeroboam was a mighty man of valor. And Solomon, seeing the young man that he was industrious, he made him ruler over all the charge of the house of Joseph. Now down towards the end, verse 40. Solomon therefore sought to kill Jeroboam, and Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt unto Shishak, king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. And the rest of the acts of Solomon, and all that he did, and his wisdom, are they not written in the book of the Acts of Solomon? And the time that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years, and Solomon slept with his father, with his fathers, and was buried in the city of David his father, and Rehoboam his son reigned in his stead. And that's our reading tonight. It will be very obvious from the verses that we have just read that this brings us to the conclusion of the life of Solomon and the reign of Solomon, at least as we have it recorded in the first book of Kings. Indeed, this final chapter of Solomon's reign doesn't occur again in the book of Chronicles. We haven't touched, or at least scarcely touched, upon the record of Chronicles in these meetings, but all I will mention is that Chronicles gives us the picture of the ideal Solomon, whereas the book of Kings gives us a picture of the actual Solomon. And the ideal Solomon and the actual Solomon were not just quite the same thing. I suppose the ideal Christian and the actual Christian are likewise not just as close replicas the one of the other as they should be. But this is the final chapter. We have on previous nights, as many of you know, I don't want to be repeating it to the point of weariness, but we have considered Solomon and his appointment, his accession to the throne, and his administration. And we have also thought about his architecture and the various activities and achievements that he engaged in. We thought about those last night, those policies, foreign affairs and home affairs. And as we said then, tonight brings us to the consideration of Solomon's apostasy and turning away from the Lord and the adversaries that arose just as a result of that. It is a pity that we have to finish the meetings on a negative note. Until now we've been going on from one platform of progress to another. I think that perhaps we reached the pinnacle of the progress last night in all the glory and splendor of Solomon's kingdom. And tonight, it's a kind of an anticlimax. We're climbing down again to ground level. The men that preach tell me you should always finish the meetings on a good note. And I just can't do that tonight. Because Solomon, unfortunately, as far as this record goes, he did not finish on a good note. So we just have to look at it and go away from the meeting, maybe feeling a little bit sad, and I trust with some solemn thoughts in our hearts as well. We began in chapter 1 and 2 with a man who was waiting for God. You remember back to Monday night, he didn't seize the throne. He had a brother that couldn't wait, a brother that was itching for position. But Solomon waited on God's time, and he acquiesced in God's method. And he got the throne from God himself. He was waiting for God. In chapters 3 and 4 of this book we spent that night indicating that the man who waited for God was characterized by wisdom from God. He administered districts of the kingdom in a very remarkable and commendable way. Then on Wednesday night we took a look at that large section, chapters 5, 6, 7 and 8. And we discovered the man who had waited upon God and exercised wisdom from God. As a priority in his kingdom, he was concerned about the worship of God. And he built the temple. And I don't want to cover it again, but he extended upon that glorious sanctuary the very best he could give it. And we give him full marks, and the Lord himself appeared to him and commended him for all that he had done. Last night, the man who had done those three things that I just mentioned, in chapters 9 and 10, he was a marvelous witness for God. Spread out the name of Jehovah across the ancient world. Was an advertisement for the glory of God as possibly no other king before him or since him has been. So effective was his witness that there was a fine lady of royal standing came from the land of Sheba and travelled the whole way with her great retinue of servants right until she landed at Jerusalem. Somebody asked me going out to the meeting last night, they said you didn't tell us how far Sheba was from Jerusalem. So I said that would give me a start off tonight. It was about 1,200 miles. So it was a massive undertaking. I would reckon with all the great company of servants and wealth and all the attendants that this royal lady had and all the spices and gold that she was carrying, the precious stones, she must have come with a great cargo of soldiers and so on. And if they were able to travel 25 miles a day, that would have been a maximum. And it likely took her the most of 6 or 7 weeks to get there. She may have spent a week or two there. And then she went away home 6 or 7 weeks back again. And I think if you had been speaking to her when she arrived back home, she would have said like Rutherford that it was a well-spent journey those 7 deaths lay between. To see the king in all his beauty and glory. Such a witness this man, the man who waited upon God.
The man whom administered with wisdom from God, the man who was concerned with the worship of God, the man who was a marvelous witness for God, is a man who in this chapter displays great weakness and wickedness before God. And we've been moving up and up and up and up, and we get an awful slump when we land into the depression of 1 Kings chapter 11. The peace of all the previous chapters is overshadowed by the problems of this chapter. In chapter 5, Solomon was speaking to another man, and he told him, he said, "The Lord has given me rest on every side." And he added these words. He said, "There is neither adversary nor evil occurrence." That was a great statement. He said, "As I look across my kingdom," he said, "the Lord has so blessed me, there's neither adversary nor evil to be seen." When you get to this chapter, verse 6 says, Solomon did evil. Verse 23 says, God stirred up another adversary. So the things that were absent in chapter 5, pleasantly absent, are the things that are now appearing in a very crude form just in this chapter. So I've said enough to let us see that the sin of Solomon's last days is very depressing and makes very sad reading. I want to say a number of things about his sin tonight that will make the body of the rest of our remarks. The first thing that I want to mention is the surprise of it. You know, there are certain people, and we wouldn't be surprised if they made a blunder or two. But you're really surprised that a man like this should stumble in such a dreadful way. You're really surprised that a man who's so wise should make such a fool of himself. Because that's exactly what he did. A wise man who made a fool of himself. You're really surprised that a man who had gone so high could stoop so low. We are surprised that a man who had so pleased the Lord could in the last chapter of his life so grieve the Lord. I think that should make us all think. You know, there is a treachery in the human heart. And there is a deceitfulness in every human breast. And I would say to all of us here, right from the few that are sitting behind me, right down to the back wall, that there's not one of us knows how we might finish up if we are overcome by the lower devices of our fallen nature. The strange thing is, some of the brethren, I think, were pointing this out at the Lurgan Conference the other day, and men have pointed it out dozens of times over the years. The strange thing is that great men usually fail on their strong point. This man has been world famous for his wisdom, and yet he dabbled in the most vile form of folly. Moses was famous for his meekness, and yet he lost his temper. There was a man who one day stood before the gate of a small Philistine city, and he acted the madman, and his spittle was running down his beard, and he feigned himself mad, and he was a real coward. You say, who is he? Do you know who he was? He was the very man that walked into the valley to meet the Philistine giant, and there wasn't another man would stand with him. And the man who in 1 Samuel chapter 17 was marked by remarkable courage, he was the man who just a few pages later was marked by despicable cowardice. Who was the man that denied the Lord? If I have read the record of the Gospels right, the man that used his tongue to deny the Lord was the man that was the best spokesman of the apostolic band. You see what I'm saying? There might be someone in the meeting here tonight, and you think on one particular point you're very strong. You would admit you would admit that there might be weaknesses here and there might be weaknesses there, but you say, on this particular thing, I'm well furnished and I'm very spiritually fit and I'm very strong. I'll tell you, that's the very thing that you need to watch. Because we are surprised that a man so wise could finish up so foolish. Secondly, I want to say a little word about the season of his sin. It tells us in verse number 4 of chapter 11, it says, it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned away his heart after other gods. When Solomon was old. We hear a great deal of ministry for young people, and I certainly would be the first to admit that we need it all plus a little bit more. We don't hear so much ministry for old people. Do you know that older Christians are liable to a great number of evils? A great number of evils. This man, the great problem really arose in his life when he was old. Now, he wasn't very old. I think he was about 55, so look at how many old people we have in this meeting. About 55. He died before he was 60. You know, the big life that he lived took a toll on him. He never lived as long as his father, and he didn't have half the troubles that his father had. There were some of the decades of Solomon's life were great periods for God, but I haven't a doubt in my mind that the worst time of Solomon's experience were the years of his 50s. The last decade was the worst. 10 chapters that are fairly good, and then one chapter that is very, very bad at the very end. You've heard me saying it before, and I'm maybe not the person to say this, and I say it with a good wee bit of disappointment and a good wee bit of fear that the last chapter of a person's life can be a very dangerous one. Some of you older Christians that have been a great help to us, some of you older brethren and sisters to whom we have looked up for an example for years, I want to say just to you kindly, and when I'm saying it, ask for your prayers for me and others like me. But you need to be very careful about the last chapter, because you could do something in the last chapter of your life that would cast a shadow over all the good chapters that have gone before. When he was old. I don't want to take the time just in this meeting to go through different instances in the Bible. You could talk about Noah. You could talk about Gideon. You could talk about Asa. You could talk about Solomon. All four of those men were men that did great things for God in the heyday of their life. And there was something happened towards the end that was very, very sad. This very man wrote in one of his books, better is the end of a thing than the beginning. But it didn't turn out like that for him, because his beginning was his best. All the problems are not with young people. You know, old Christians can get sidetracked. One of the problems for you old believers, not many of you have it, I don't think any of you have it here, one of the great problems you can have is becoming just a crabbed old Christian. I notice a lot of older folks, they become crotchety in their old day, and hardly anybody could live with them, and the whole thing's gone, and everybody's a failure, and there's nothing right, and they get a very melancholy spirit, and every time you're talking to them, they have a depressing effect upon the atmosphere, and they have succumbed, although they don't know it, to one of the dangers of old age. And it's a sin. You say it's a very small sin. It may be, but unfortunately, it's a very prevalent one. I wasn't very long saved. It's maybe 25 years ago, just about that, maybe 26. And at the time, I happened to be reading a book, a commentary, on a book of the New Testament. I'll not tell you the man who wrote it. It was very thorough. At that time, there were parts of it a bit deeper than I was able to fathom. There were good parts of it I could understand, and I got great help from the book. I discovered that the same man had written two other commentaries on other parts of the Bible, and the brethren found them very helpful in various places. Just about that time that I was finding such help in the book, I went to the Easter conference with the others, and there was a brother there from America. That's where this man lived. And he mentioned his name. And of course I pricked up my ears to listen twice as well, just because he mentioned his name. And you know what he told us? It gave me an awful shake as a young Christian. He told us that the man who wrote those three books, he finished up his day as a drunkard in the pubs of Chicago. I never really got over that, you know. It gave me a shake that you never knew how mighty a man can be. He could write books, he could preach sermons, he could fill halls, he could captivate crowds, and just the left lying prostrate, a victim of sin in the flesh, and the testimony almost gone. When he was old, and you would nearly feel like stopping the meeting and spending the rest of the time in prayer, crying to God for preservation. The next thing that I want to mention is the surroundings in which Solomon did sin. You know, many men have given in under adversity, and you wouldn't blame them too much. You wouldn't want to be too hard on them. But it wasn't adversity that made this man collapse. He lived in the lap of luxury. He had everything a person could ask for. Indeed, I'm inclined to think that maybe a contributing factor to this failure was just the luxury in which he lived. I have a little thought, you know, that the wealth that we talked about last night went to his head. Too much wealth. All those golden drinking vessels. All that gold that was coming in. You remember, there was a verse we read there one of the nights last night, maybe we didn't read it, but it's in chapter 10, just the previous chapter. One of these navies that went to a particular part of the world, they brought them back apes and monkeys and one thing or another, and baboons and peacocks. And I think he had plenty of time to sit and watch them. Acting the monkey, and these peacocks strutting about, and he had everything that heart could want, and everything that heart could wish for. And it was maybe just the luxury, and you know, there's not luxury can lead to license, and extravagance can lead to excess. I think the pleasant surroundings in which Solomon lived, and all the comforts of his royal court, they didn't only make the man soft physically, but they made him soft spiritually and morally. Now, I have to say a little bit of word to us all. There are very few Christians in this meeting tonight don't have a little few luxuries. And I'm not going to complain about our houses, because most of us have very comfortable surroundings. And I'll not be crying about your comfortable surroundings, because you could come and see that mine are maybe just as comfortable as yours, or just as comfortable as I want anyway. Now, we are living in great spiritual danger because of that. The materialism, the consumerism, the secularism. Most of you Christians have a fairly good bank account. Most of you have a good bit of savings. Most of you haven't a bit of a worry about the future. Most of you have a freezer that is full. For all I know, there could be some of you have already booked a great big holiday for next year. Some of you people think nothing of spending £2,000 or £3,000 on a good holiday. That's your own business before the Lord. If you can tell him you do that and you're happy to do it, I'm not going to interfere. He'll talk to you about that eventually. But we'll not worry about that. But you can spend that and you never would even bat an eye. And we're living in days when there's just plenty. Remember, brethren and sisters, the materialism of the Western world, I feel that it's leading us away from God. And we haven't a touch. You know,
I haven't traveled very much, but I've been one or two little bits and pieces. I haven't yet. There may be. I don't doubt there are. But I haven't yet been in any place where I have met Christians that were more affluent than Northern Ireland. But I've been in places where Christians were a lot less affluent, and I got the idea that they were much more spiritual. And they had more joy in the Lord. And they had less bickering in the meeting. And they had less jealousy amongst the sisters. And they had less criticism in the corner. Because they were living, maybe not so much in material poverty, but they were so enjoying the Lord that material things didn't even count for them. That's the bigger thing. If we were enjoying the Lord, you know, the bits of things that we are daft about, we get excited about our cars, we get excited about our homes, and we get excited about our carpets, and you need a little bit of all those things. But those things that we are so much excited about, brethren and sisters, when all said and done, they're worth nothing. And the very blessings that God allowed this man to enjoy, I have a little suspicion in my mind that those were the very blessings that beguiled his heart and began to take him away from the Lord. And he was so much surrounded by material bounty that he began to lose the vision of eternal realities. His surroundings contributed to his sin. Likely another thing that took its toll on him was that with all that leisure, with all that luxury, he was also probably a man who had a great amount of work. The administration, I know he had plenty of delegates and helpers and so on, but the administration of that great empire must have kept Solomon tremendously busy. And likely it got so much in his mind that it was difficult for Solomon to get times of quiet communion with God, such as he would have needed, with all the responsibilities that devolved upon him. I would imagine that maybe I'm touching again a point that's a great sore point in our day. Christians find it difficult to get quiet time alone with God. Now, the pressure meant that Solomon had to have some pleasure. You see, that's a problem. And let me talk very plainly, because these things could bring us down. Most of you people are living under pressure. You see, that's a problem. And let me talk very plainly, because these things could bring us down. Most of you people are living under pressure. This word that we've got now, stress. Stress has become a great word in our society. Well, that's all right. It is a reality. A certain amount of stress is good for people, you know. Leisure all the time is very bad, but a certain amount of stress is good. But I think the pressure that Solomon was under made him that he had to take a good wee bit of pleasure. That's why he needed these monkeys and one thing or another to entertain him and dance about in the windowsills and keep him happy and climb up around the beams and all that sort of thing. And that was relaxation. And that got, many Christians told me, said, you know, I needed to get the television because I was under so much pressure at work, I just had to relax. I needed something to help me to relax. And then they tell you, but you go to the meeting, you can't relax at the meeting. Sure, it's the Bible reading, and boys will be talking about the Aorist tense or something, and you couldn't relax, and you go from one pressure just onto, but you need to have some idea of relaxing. Now, I can see there are many Christians, and their life is made up of pressure, and then to offset the pressure, they have to dabble in a good pleasure. And when you take the pressure plus the pressure, there's very little room left for fellowship with God. That's the kind of situation that this great man found himself crushed in the days of the greatness of his empire. I'm just sounding a warning for all this materialism that's around us and within us on every side. Then, we have to take a little look at just the specific sin. That's the circumstances in which it took place. We have to look at the specific sin that Solomon committed. What it was that made the Lord angry. We're told here in verse number 1 that King Solomon loved many strange women. Women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites. You say, what are you going to say about this? Now, the strange women weren't unusual women. I need hardly say that.
Women do can be strange, I know, from time to time and from place to place. But we leave that subject for another night, and I think I leave it to another person as well. I'd like to live for another year or two. But the word strange in this verse means foreign. Not strange in their personality, but foreign in their nationality and religion. And King Solomon had an affection for many of those foreign women. If he did want to have a number of wives, it was a very unadvisable thing. Polygamy was condemned by the Bible, but I would have imagined that there would have been enough beautiful ladies in Israel. But no, they didn't do Solomon. Solomon was a broad-minded man, and he had plenty of influence, and he thought that he would get his pick from the kingdoms of the world. You see, power, and a man gets power, he can abuse it tremendously. He had the money to pay for the needs, and he had the power. Now, the one problem with this, Solomon is not condemned for being sensual. That's what many people think. Now, he's not condemned for that here. I'm not altogether happy just to take it in that he was a man who lived in the depths of sensuality. That's never mentioned. There may have been a degree of that. But the one thing that is mentioned, it tells us in this verse, he took women of those nations concerning which the Lord had said, ye shall not go into them, neither shall they come into you, for they'll turn away your heart. Now, in taking those ladies, he went exactly against what the Lord told him. He was breaking the commandment of the Lord. Now that was a very serious thing for him to do. Just to put it in a word, blatant disobedience to God's word. Now when he began his friendship with these ladies, the problem was that when they married Solomon, or when he brought them into his court, they didn't change their religion. You see, there wasn't a strong prohibition altogether against the marriage of all foreign people. For example, Ruth was a foreigner, and one of the great men of Israel married a foreigner. She was a strange woman. But before she got married to Boaz, there was a day she said, thy God shall be my God. Rahab was a foreigner. She got married into the royal line. But before Rahab got married into the royal line, she had become a convert to the Jehovah, the God of Israel. But these women didn't leave their religion when they came to Solomon's court. So that the reason he was condemned for this was because he married women that were of a different religious persuasion. And God told him, he said, now Solomon, and any who were with him, he said, Solomon, if you're going to bring that into your life, and if you're going to divide your affections with those women that are heathen and pagan in their outlook, he said, there'll not be as much in your life for me. And he said, it just simply comes to this, that no man can serve two masters. And God said, I'm not going to be happy, Solomon, with your divided affections. And these ladies, when they came, they brought just all their corruption with them. Now, would I be speaking to anybody here, and you're a Christian, and you're just thinking now of becoming engaged to a non-believer. Maybe there's a young believer in this meeting, and you're about to commence a friendship. Maybe you've been asked to go out with a non-believer, brother or sister or otherwise. Maybe somebody you work with. Now, you remember that in taking that step, you're breaking an express commandment of the Lord. You say, but I'm praying about it, and I want to know where the Lord would guide me. I think that's a very nice unbeliever, and I want to know where the Lord would guide me to go out with him or to go out with her, accept the overtures. I'm praying about it. I would like to say to you in the meeting just now, you don't need to pray about it beyond tonight, because God has told you it's wrong. You can stop now. It says that Solomon took the pick of these many women from the very nations that God said, you'll not do it. And as far as I can see in my Bible, it's impossible for a person to fly in the face of God and to expect prosperity or his blessing. Now, why did he do this? I've already declared myself that he likely didn't do this because of sensuality, primarily. I wouldn't say that's not a measure of that in it. He may have done it for political reasons. You see, In those days, one of the ways to strengthen your kingdom was to marry into the royal family of another kingdom. And Solomon thought, if I can marry into the family of that king over there, well then he'll not fight against me because I've got his daughter. You see. And he thought, the more of these fine ladies that I can get from the kingdom, you know if the king of Tyre Haram had 20 of these ladies in Solomon's harem, he wasn't going to send a bomb to the palace, because 20 of his fine girls were going to get killed. And Solomon says, the more of these I can get around me and get into the confines of my palace, he says, it'll protect me and it'll strengthen my position. But instead of strengthening his position, it actually weakened it. You know, sometimes we think that making concessions and disobeying the word of God will be to our advantage. It might seem to be to our advantage temporarily, but eventually it'll be for our undoing. Another reason, and I think this was very much the reason, if you had lived away back in those ancient times, one of the problems you'd have had was being able to keep a wife. They weren't easy to keep then. I don't know if it has changed much or not, but it was very difficult to keep a wife. Now, if you were, I'm not talking about godly men, they never thought about this, but if you were an ungodly man and you had a good bit of money, well, you kept two wives. And if you wanted to know just how wealthy a man was, you asked him, how many wives does he have? Still like this in Africa. And if he said, I have six wives, you knew there's a fella has a pound or two. And if you were a king, you would maybe have 200 wives. And if this man can have 300, and if this man can have 400, I'm a bigger king than them all. And he said, I have 1,000. And poor Solomon became so worldly in his outlook that he began to compete with the world and do what the world did, only he tried to do it a little bit better. You know, I fear that many Christians are stupid to that. They're just trying to do the things the world do. And they're trying to achieve status symbols. And really, if we had rightly assessed our position, we would have to do as we've been singing, take the world but give me Jesus, all its joys are but a name. Competing with the world, it was a very poor thing for this man to be doing. Then it got worse, you see. We're told here, they turned away his heart. Some of you were here on Tuesday night. We read a lovely verse there in chapter 3. It says that Solomon loved the Lord. Tells us here that Solomon loved many strange women. His affections are divided and his affections for the Lord are cooling. Maybe it wouldn't be out of place if I drew a halt just in the meeting for a minute and asked ourselves the question, how many of us have affections and are beginning to cool? Take our spiritual temperature. Many believers know. They know as sure as they're going on that things are not just as warm with me as they used to be. Many Christians, once they wouldn't have missed a meeting, or else they broke their heart over it, now they could miss a meeting without a qualm. The thing's cooling. Solomon's affections are being divided. He does things that previously he wouldn't have done. You see, those of you who have been here, and as these things build up that you notice the significance of them, one of the things that we made a reference to a couple of times, and there were more of them, there were three things that Solomon was very particular about. He was very particular about building and very particular about burning. Those were two things. Building, build the temple, and built all these other cities that we talked about, fortification towns and so on. We talked about them last night. Solomon was constantly building for God. And then you remember last night, it says that he had burnt offerings. The first night we talked about, no, Tuesday, 1,000 burnt offerings. There was another night, he had 220,000 burnt offerings. Bring them upon the altar. Built the temple for God, and he filled the altar with burnt offerings. Building and burning. You look at it now. You didn't look at the Bible. Listen to this. Solomon built a high place for Chemosh. And for Molech. And he did this for his wives, which burned incense. and sacrificed unto their gods. I could hardly believe that, you know. The man that built the temple was the very man that built an idol's chapel. And the man that burnt incense and burnt offerings unto Jehovah in a marvelous supply was the man that was giving his wives animals to burn to their false gods. And what was going up to their false gods, I needn't tell you, wasn't going up to the true God. The energy he used to put into the one, he has now put onto the... I have a little thing in my mind that puts a little bit of fear there as well. You know, sometimes it has been known. I wouldn't think it has been known around Puerto Down, but men have built things in the last years of their life that they never would have thought of building in the earlier years. Men that built for God earlier could end up building for idolatry. And one of the sad features of this is just this. These things that Solomon built on the Mount of Olives, if you please, that means just on the mount to the north of the city, he built the temple. Then there was a valley, and over on the other side of that valley was the Mount of Olives, and the man that built the temple here for God was building idolatrous shrines here opposite over in the other, just where the two were looking and laughing at each other. Inconsistency. What he's doing now is a direct denial of what he did then. You would say, well, sure, they would fall down. Do you know what I'm going to tell you? The strange thing is that these idle things that Solomon built, there's a passage away over here in the second book of Kings, and 300 years later, they're still there. 300 years later, they're still there. I doubt if you had spoken to Solomon and said, Solomon, do you realize that what you're building for this lady from Moab, do you realize that it'll still be there as an eyesore 300 years after you're gone? He would say, that talks sense. He says, you have to keep her happy. You don't say a thing about it. There'd be a whole problem at home. If I didn't do this over here, there'd be a whole problem at home. And he said, you don't say a word about it. How many men have made concessions because of their wives' interests? He said, but sure, it'll not last. I'm just doing it to keep her happy. It'll not last. I tell you, whatever we do by the way of compromise, it'll likely still be there long after we have departed. So I think I said enough. I don't want to go on to it anymore about the seriousness of this specific sin that Solomon had committed. Far, far more outreach than ever this man imagined. How did the Lord look upon it? Well, maybe before I just say that, I should say this. It didn't happen overnight. You know, people that turn away from the Lord and do the likes of what we are talking about here, a complete turn away, it's not something that just go to bed on Wednesday night and it happens on Thursday morning. You know, it's gradual. Now, I'm going to talk about a thing about which there's been some disagreement here, but I'm going to tell you my own mind, and then you can work it out from there. When did all this start? I think it started way back very early. In chapter 3, now those were good days. We were here talking about that in chapter 3, the night that he prayed and the Lord gave him wisdom. That's the chapter 3. Just at the beginning of that chapter, it tells us that Solomon took the daughter of Pharaoh to be his wife. Now, was that a mistake or not? Many believe that Solomon shouldn't be condemned for marrying the daughter of Pharaoh. It's not directly condemned in the scriptures. When he married Moabites and Ammonites and Edomites, there's no question about it. God had said earlier in the Old Testament, he said, those old wicked nations, he says, don't you marry their wives because you'll end up worshipping their gods. God said, now don't do it, Edomites, Ammonites, Moabites. But there was no verse that said, thou shalt not marry an Egyptian. Because of that, many have thought that Solomon was all right in marrying an Egyptian. Now in this chapter, it says, King Solomon loved many strange wives together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, and so on. Mr. Darby and others translate that he loved many strange women besides the daughter of Pharaoh. And quite a number of our good brethren, books and scholars, students, preachers, etc., they have said that this daughter of Pharaoh was in a different category, and she wasn't as black or as bad as these other ones. Well, I can see a grain of truth in that, but yet and withal, in my heart of hearts, I think that Solomon started on a slippery slope very early. And it's as far back as chapter 3. And what begins in chapter 3 in a small way, and he married one foreign woman, by the time you get to chapter 11, there's a thousand of them. If you had said to Solomon at that stage, "Solomon, now I think this is a wee bit dangerous, and this could turn out very bad," I would say he would likely have looked you straight in the face and said, "Now look, I know all about it, and I know as much about it as you, but I'm going to control it. And it will not get out of hand." Now, let me say another thing. When he married the daughter of Pharaoh, when he did a doubtful thing, he wasn't breaking any specific commandment. But he very quickly moved on from doing a doubtful thing to doing things that were direct disobedience. It could be, I've heard the argument, I've heard people talk about it many a time, it could be that there's some Christian in this meeting and you're contemplating doing something and you would say to me if we talked about it, there's no verse in the Bible against it. My word to you tonight is this: if you're not happy about it, don't do it. And if you think it's doubtful, you keep hands off. Because doubt produced disobedience. And the marrying of the daughter of Pharaoh, while it mightn't have been a gross evil, it certainly, I'll admit myself, it wasn't nearly as bad as these other ones. It wasn't as bad as that, but it was just the thin edge of the wedge. And it led from one stage to another. I would tell you, indeed I tell about it sometime. There was a brother I went to see in hospital quite an age, I mean a man in the 70s. And I asked him how he was and so on. And then he started to cry. I didn't really know what was wrong. I didn't know him very well. I didn't know his history. And he sobbed his way, and when he got steadied, he said to me, "Dermot, you know," he said, "I'm getting back a wee bit now," but he said, "I have wasted 40 years of my life." That took me by surprise. I wasn't thinking about that at all. He said, "You know, I was out of a meeting. I got away from the Christians." I said, "What happened? If you don't..." Oh, he says, "I'll tell you what happened, no problem." He said, "There was nothing bad happened." He said, "I got involved with the army," and he said, "I stopped coming to the meetings." And then he said, "I got some poor company." And he said, "I wasn't too long with the poor company till I stopped praying private prayer and I stopped diligent reading of the scriptures." And he said, "That didn't too long stop until I became cold and hurt." And he says, "I just spent 40 years of my life," and he said, "I haven't a crack of the fingers to show God spiritually." He says, "I never really did anything bad," but he said, "It all started so gradually, and it ended up so serious." I would wonder, many a man has ended up in drink. I hope, they tell me, I don't know these things from personal experience, but they tell me amongst young believers in some parts, I don't expect any here involved, now, there's a great tendency nowadays to dabble in social drinking. And some of you are at universities, and you have to go to these old things. I tell you, you go to as few worldly functions as you possibly can be at. And my advice is, your Christmas dinner, I know these dear brethren are not like this, they'll think I'm too strong. Your Christmas dinner at your work, you try and stay as far away from it as possible. Now, if you ask you to give thanks to the eye, they wouldn't, they'll laugh at you behind your back. Far more to take your stand for God. Dabbling in social drinking. Many a man that has ended up in the back seat, he could tell you when he first started to tinker with the thing. Married a daughter of Egypt, nothing big about it, no express commandment about it, but then he had 1,000 wicked women with their paganism and idolatry all around him, and I would love to have got to Solomon then and said, Solomon, Solomon.
You know, God did get to him. God spoke to him in chapter 3. Just after he married that lady, God spoke to him. You know what God said to him? He said, Solomon, he said, I want to tell you, he said, keep walking in my ways, and he said, I'll lengthen your life
if you keep walking in my way. That was just after he married this lady. The Lord didn't mention the lady, but he said, Solomon, keep walking in my ways.
Solomon didn't walk in the ways of the Lord, and he filled the grave at a man about 58. But it all started so small. We have to watch the start of things, because they can lead to great disasters. The Lord was very angry about it, just for the reason that I've nearly already mentioned. He pronounced a very severe sentence on him. And I'll conclude the meeting here just in a minute or two. It tells us here in verse number 9, the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart, I can't mention the importance of the heart here, his heart was turned from the Lord God of Israel, which appeared unto him twice. Not a very serious thing. God said, now Solomon, he said, what makes me so angry is that I appeared unto you twice. Now, God didn't appear to everybody. But to this man, God gave him two special occasions when he had a personal appearance of the Lord. Any man should have been impressed with the glory of the Lord. It was Solomon. The glory of the Lord in the temple. Two special appearances. And the Lord said, in spite of all the privileges, my dear man, that I gave you, he said, you turned away from me, even though I spoke to you on two occasions. And he said, I commanded you. He said, I told you. You know, a thing that I imagine is very solemn, and it's just this, that knowledge and privilege are not enough to preserve a Christian. I need to repeat that. A knowledge of the Bible is good, but a knowledge of the Bible is not enough to preserve a Christian. This man has given us some of the great books of the Bible. You parents read the book of Proverbs. I know, can you think of how many chapters in the book of Proverbs talk about the wicked woman and the foolish woman? This man knew all about it, and then he married 1,000 of them. Because knowledge of the theory wasn't enough to preserve the man in his activity. And I would say just to all of us here, it's great to come to ministry meetings, you know. And it's great to go to Bible readings, and it's great to read the books, and it's great to study the Bible. All those things are advantageous, but they don't necessarily preserve the Christian. He needs to keep within his heart a sanctuary where the Lord is constantly being feared. Fellowship with God will keep the Christian, but mere knowledge in his head will not be enough to preserve his feet in the times of danger. Now, he knew it, and the Lord was severe on him, because he said, I was speaking to a man just last week, and he made a statement that I was impressed with. He was telling me about the way they did things in County Cork 60 years ago. And he told me about people that got saved and things that happened. And he says, we wouldn't do it now. He said, like, it was terrible. I mean, they let people break bread and they weren't baptized or anything. And they had a man got saved, and they didn't know anything about it. They just brought him along and let him tell how he got saved at the meeting that night, the first night. He had broken bread that morning, not baptized or anything. You people, it would nearly keep you from sleeping tonight if you knew that. And the Lord saved people in that very meeting. Sure, that's against all that you have said this week, Jilly lad. You've told us that obedience is the secret to success, and prosperity will come out of obedience. Yes, yes, I said that surely a number of times, and this book mentions that very, very clearly. But there were men, and they were doing what was against the word of God, and yet the Lord blessed them. You say, well, how? But he says, I'll tell you, David, he says, we wouldn't be doing that now. But he says, we know now. He says, we've been taught. He says, we knew nothing then. And this is what he had. That's what I want everybody to get. He says, you know, I have learned in my life, this is a man well in his 80s, he says that the Lord is very merciful to ignorance. But he says he takes a very dim view of arrogance. Now, people make a mistake because they don't know. But remember, most Christians who make serious blunders, they do it in spite of the fact that they do know. They have been warned, they have been told, they have been instructed, they know that they're doing wrong. But you say, how is it that a person will do wrong even when he knows it's wrong? It's because the power of the flesh and sin is so severe that it can carry a man even over what is mine. The Lord tolerates ignorance, but he's very severe on arrogance and willfulness. Solomon wasn't ignorant, he was arrogant. I'll have to finish. It wouldn't be so bad, you know, if this man's evil just affected himself. But unfortunately, the sequel to this all was a very sad list of events that I can't go into tonight. The great kingdom started to break up. There was a breakaway sort of a boy. Most of these fellows that run away and start up things on their own, it's not a great thing in the Bible. There were two fellows in this chapter, and they ran away from their master, and then they gathered a band of men around them and started up a breakaway kind of a thing. So it has been going on for years. So they had one of them up in the north, and they had one of them down in the south, and Solomon couldn't control them. And it was bad enough to get resistance from the outside, but there was a man that actually worked for Solomon on the inside in the very city of Jerusalem, and he started to rebel against them, and he took away 10 tribes from them. And when Solomon died, I know that happened just a little bit later, when Solomon died, unfortunately he had to give over to his son a kingdom that was a great bit smaller than it should have been. It was smaller, and it wasn't too long until it was split. He could have given him the whole lot if he had behaved himself, all the wealth and all, but he gave him a kingdom that was greatly reduced. I'm thankful, you know, that there was a kingdom at all. As well, the whole thing wasn't smashed and closed. God allowed the kingdom to survive. That was his grace. But he had it greatly reduced because that was his government. You know, it really amazes me. Sometimes we talk about assemblies getting smaller. It amazes me, brothers and sisters, we misbehave so much at times. It's a wonder the thing's going on at all. It's no wonder we're small. God's government would keep us small because we couldn't handle big things. God's government reduced the thing, but God's grace carried it on. It might have been a smaller kingdom, but it went to the Son. And I know things are weak amongst us and sins haven't been committed and much failure, but I do believe that even though it reduces, God will keep it carrying on until we hear the trumpet sound and at last the Saviour comes. The chapter begins with a but. But King Solomon. The chapter ends with a burial. And in between we have one of the saddest chapters of the Bible. I trust the Lord will keep us. The last chapter can be dangerous, and I trust he'll keep us for his glory, shall we pray. Our Father, we bow in the name of the Lord Jesus. We think again of these solemn principles from thy word. We think of all the snares and the fools that surround us, and the lusts and fears within, and we do acknowledge that the grace that sought and found us alone can keep us clean. We ask thy preservation. We know that the temptations are more than we could cope with in our own strength.